So, how's everybody doing? Anybody dying to ask a question? Am I going too fast, or you can't hear what I'm saying? Okay. Well, just as a roundup of that last little meditation we did, a quote from Asanga. So Asanga is a great Indian Buddhist master, of course, and great, I mean, one of you know, Premier League for certain. And so he gives various explanations about how to meditate on impermanence. And his form of progress is like very thorough, very complete. He's not one of those people say, oh, just meditate on your breath and impermanence it emerges as you just meditate on the one object. He's very much saying, you know, you have to go through the whole, well, you have to, but he's saying, you know, meditate on the outer phenomena being impermanent, the inner phenomena being impermanent, you know, methodically as possible, go through, you know, as many objects as possible and see they're all impermanent. So just this author is describing, this isn't a direct quote, outer objects, for instance, outer objects, what we've just been doing, are similarly examined in terms of 16 categories that range from the surrounding physical environment, both a natural world of forests, mountains, and bodies of water, and man-made elements such as buildings, fields, and places of commerce and industry, to all manner of personal objects such as food, vehicles for travel, clothing, jewelry, tools, and other paraphernalia that are used in daily life. The practitioner reflects on the manner in which each of these types of objects undergoes changes that include being newly created, varying with the fluctuation of season and climate, being ravaged by wind, fire, or flood, etc., and simply undergoing gradual deterioration. See, so he's really sort of doing this sort of vast type of meditation. And then this is a direct quote. The practitioner should perceive the manner in which each of these things that appear successively is recent, not old, transitory, temporary, momentary, and subject to change. Having perceived this, he or she should reflect how remarkable is the impermanence of these conditioned entities. So this translator is using conditioned entities. I've used the term compounded things. Both meaning the same. So that's your sort of an introduction to meditation and on sort of the gross, more obvious kinds of impermanence. And you know, the next meditation we can do will be on, you know, sort of turning inwards to looking at ourselves and meditating on death. So we'll do that for as an appetite for lunch.
Sorry, I didn't put the microphone on.
But let's see what Genlan Rinpoche has to say. The first part is, as I said, is like just a talk about compounded things without so much of the concentration on impermanence itself. So I'll talk a little bit about that and then maybe jump over a section. I mean, it's very helpful, but you know, we've got limited time, so I'll read the first page or so and then see how we get on. So where have we got to? First of all, we're talking about the first section, the indicator compounded things. And with regard to that, with regard to the first, there are two. A general explanation by way of the meaning of the term and particular explanations by way of natures. So different types of compounded things that he picks on. So first of all, the general explanation. Thus it was said, conditions manifold compound, through this phenomena arise. conditions manifold compound, and so there's no inherent being.
So, you know, this the fact of things arising from causes is your way you get an insight into impermanence, but it's also a way you get into, you know, your understanding of selflessness. You know, things are dependent upon causes and conditions, therefore they cannot have any inherent nature of their own. So that's, you know, very compact, concise verse there. As it says, outer and inner phenomena are not produced without causes, from inappropriate causes or from partial causes, but they are produced from the compounding together or meeting of their own many appropriate causes and conditions, hence compounded things. If you translated that Tibetan word more literally, you'd end up with something like compounded products. But that doesn't sound quite so, you know, easy somehow. Somebody's got conditioned entities, you see. So the translation of that term is a bit fluid, really. But I think we see what it means. He's given a clear explanation there. In a word, they arise in dependence upon their mere collection of dependently related causes and conditions. So he's given a few points there. Not produced without causes, from inappropriate causes, or from partial causes. So that's he's just going to go expand on that pronouncement. In this way, just as a green shoot will not arise from empty space, nothing whatever arises without a cause. So we may desire a particular result, but we have to make effort at the cause. In the same way that a rice shoot, oh no, so that's a second point. Yeah, so nothing arises without a cause. Very obvious, but you know, thinking along these lines, I hope, gets us sensitized to the fact that things are arising from causes and conditions. And so when do they arise from causes and conditions? Just at the beginning of their, you know, continuum of existence, or all the time. But here he's just saying, you know, don't expect a green shoot to arise from empty space. So, you know, everything that you see around you has got to have its appropriate cause. So, of course, in terms of the path, we're looking then at, you know, what's the cause of suffering. And this is where you have to, you know, investigate alternatives to a Buddhist presentation of where suffering comes from. You know, if you ask somebody who's a confirmed materialist, materialist, sort of scientific materialist, you know, where does suffering come from? Well, they you know, they can point to various things like, you know, this particular bodily condition, you know, is giving rise to an illness, and that illness is, you know, playing upon the nerves that spread throughout your body, and therefore you're feeling really rough. You know, sort of they can give a very sort of skillful and you know, detailed explanation up to a certain point. But then you ask them, so why is it me who has to suffer this, you know, whatever debilitating condition? Why is it me who's got to suffer this? And some other person, you know, like they're just walking around having a good time, but it's me who's, you know, confined to my wheelchair or whatever, so on and so on. So this, you know, then if you keep pressing questions like that, what answer are you going to get from the materialist? You know, in the end, it's something like, oh well, it's just the lottery of life, isn't it? You know, that you have to get this disease and somebody else doesn't. Of course, they can talk about, you know, oh well, your genes of your parents were a bit mismatched, and so therefore you have, you know, this tendency to this, you know, condition, you know, because of the way your parents' genes combine. You know, so then you say, well, why is it my parents that have to have dodgy genes, you know, and not somebody else's parents? So then, you know, there's a question of why the suffering at the mental level, you know, the physical explanation is very skillful and, you know, on that basis, excellent cures or, you know, relief for your particular condition can come up, can't it? But, you know, why is it me who's got to suffer? So then a lot of people will just end up with the answer, it's just a lottery of life or something like that, isn't it, won't they? They'll say it's just like chance. But this is specifically rejecting that as a possible explanation. So But nothing occurs by chance, you know. Just as a green shoot will not arise from empty space. Nothing arises by chance. If something arises by chance, then anything can arise by chance. You know? So Jesus walked on the water. You have to accept that because it just happened by chance, you know. So this the sort of the thoughts can arise from these layout of the basic principles of cause and effect. So in the middle of that paragraph, in the same way that a rice shoot will not arise from the barley seed, nothing whatsoever will arise from an inappropriate cause. So we may desire a particular result, but we have to rely on the appropriate causes. Yes, so the effect will always be, you know, from the effect that's suited to that, the effect will always be from the cause that's suited to that effect. Yeah? So there's got to be that sense of, you know, there's got to be a sense of, you know, favorable cause rising, giving rise to a favorable effect. And an unfavorable effect will come from an unfavorable cause. So here we can think about, you know, karma. So if you have the unfavorable effect suffering, that's got to come from an appropriate effect. So what more appropriate effect than, you know, the fact that you put out suffering to others in the past and that's coming back at you. So you put out help and happiness to other people, so then that is ripening back on you as favorable, you know, good fortune. So the question of appropriate and inappropriate cause for our feelings of happiness and suffering is raised there if we want to pursue that one. And then the third principle. If the causes and conditions, seed, water, manure, and so forth, are not complete, then the shoot will not arise. Just so, nothing whatsoever arises from an incomplete collection of causes. So we may desire a particular result, but we have to amass the complete collection of its causes. So, you know, we have to be thorough. If we are practicing the path, you know, it's not just a sort of partial practice that will bring us success. We have to be more methodical than that. So we have to, do whatever is necessary to bring about the result of our understanding, our bit of insight, a bit of wisdom, or generating more strongly our feelings of kindness and concern for others. So what are the complete causes for that to happen? So not just a partial practice. And then we have to get the causes in the right order. We have to go step by step. No good just jumping to the later causes, neglecting the preliminary causes. So if we mix up the order of ploughing the field and spreading the manure and so forth, then a bountiful harvest will not arise. Likewise, nothing whatever arises if the order of the causes is mixed up. So we may desire a particular result, but we have to make sure we do not mix up the order of the causes. Yeah, so that's sometimes in our Dharma practice. We relate it to that, you know. People are keen to get this result, keen to have this, higher kind of realization. So they're trying to do the higher practices, but neglecting the basics, you know. So this is something you can, see sometimes. And then another thing to think about. Even if all the conducive conditions, like water and manure, are complete, if they're not free of opposing conditions, like frost and hail, the crop will not arise. In this fashion, nothing whatsoever arises if overcome by opposing conditions. So we may desire a particular result, but we have to clear away the opposing conditions. So one example we always had to debate upon was, you know, you have a field in the spring and the farmer plants his seed. His barley seed, this Tibetan farmer. You know, and there's warmth in the ground at last. You know, the snow is melted, so the fields are kind of, you know, the soil is moist from the melted snow. And, the sun is rising high in the sky. The sun has got strength in it. And so the farmer, you know, scatters his seed onto the soil. So then they say, you know, considering that seed, you know, is it a cause of the green shoot? You what, Radek? Yeah. Well, on this topic here, you see, so the Tibetan farmer, you know, he's farming these high-altitude lands, he waits for the snow to melt, but that's good because the snow is what irrigates his field. He doesn't necessarily get much rain, but the snow is irrigation. So the snow's melted on the field, you know, the sun is warm in the sky, so the ground's warmed up, you know, it's nice and moist, and then he spread his fertilizer on the field. So then, you know, he scatters his seeds. So considering the subject, the seed, which is, you know, along with all those conducive conditions, is it the cause of a green shoot? Pardon? Well, why not? Because the debate goes on. This crow comes down, you know, and flies down and just picks that or seed and gobbles it up. I'm talking about this particular one, yeah? We keep it to one, otherwise it's a bit too full. The crow? Won't it be digested? Or a pigeon, yeah? We have a lot of wood pigeons where I live, even in domestic gardens now, so they'll eat your seeds. So barley seed is just what they'd like. So they have rock pigeons up in the Tibetan fields, you know, so the pigeon comes down, just swallows the seed and digests it. Yeah, well, if it... Yeah, so this is it. So if it doesn't produce its effect, then it hardly can be considered a cause. Or can it, you know? What does it take to be a cause? Does it have to have produced its effect?
Maybe it had another, it was destined to do something.
So then it's a cause of something else. It's a cause of the pigeon having nourishment, you know. But it's a cause of the pigeon's body. Yeah, the seed ceases without producing a green shoot, so it sounds like it's not a cause of the green shoot. So even all the conditions, the conducive conditions are complete, you know, if there's an opposing condition suddenly comes in, he mentions frost or hail, and then, you know, your crop will not arise. So just another thing to think about if you want to, you know, create the complete cause and conditions for your desired result. So, we won't spend time on that, but yeah, it is one of a great topic for debate. You know, what does something have to be, what does something actually have to do to be a cause, you know? At what point can you say that seed is a cause of a green shoot? Not of something else like a, you know...
The cause is only manifest when the effect is known.
Yeah, it's somehow like the cause, it's got to be guaranteed, hasn't it? Yeah, by the time you can identify it as a cause, it's gone out of existence because it's produced the effect, which is a bit weird, you know. Yeah, I mean, what is a seed? A seed is something that has the potential to produce a green sprout. You know, like we'd say an infertile seed, maybe we shouldn't call that a seed, yeah? That's like a seed has got to have the potential to produce a green sprout. So that's like the meaning of a seed, really.
Seeds are also food.
Definitely we can say it has other effects, you know, like it makes the gives nourishment to the pigeon. But it's a real sort of problem question, that. And it's not just Buddhist philosophers who worried about that or wondered about it. You know, I'm sure Aristotle and people like that have got things to say about it. You know, by the time it gives up its entity into the effect, it goes out of existence. So you can only really say it's a cause when you've seen the effect, but by that time it's no longer existing. You know, so there's lots of stuff to think about. Yeah, it's if the seed gives up its entity into the sprout, then we say the seed doesn't exist anymore. The seed has changed into a sprout. Yeah.
It's also changed into part of the pigeon.
Or changed into part of the pigeon, yeah.
Isn't it just a continual process?
Hmm. Well, in the end, that's what you start. That's where our thoughts are being directed, I think, by this kind of debate. Well, that's one of the things to realise. That's, you know, that's getting down to impermanence at a more, as I say, more subtle level. Yeah, that it is just a process of continual change. And we make dividing lines. You know, this is a seed, that's a sprout, and that's fair enough. We have to. I mean, the farmer's got to, you know, be skillful in planting his field and so forth, raising his crop. So he's got to know the difference between a seed and a sprout and a barley seed and a rice seed, of course. You've got to make these distinctions. But yeah, it's the process of change is going on continually. It's not like first the seed is produced and then that's some kind of static entity. And then the sprout is produced and that's some kind of static entity. And the other thing to notice is, you know, that the cause will always precede the effect. And in order for the effect to arise, the cause has to cease. Yeah, the cause ceases, then the effect arises. So there's a, you know, if it's the direct effect of the cause, then of course there's no time gap. Yeah, the cause ceases, and then its immediate effect begins. Yeah, so. The cause, you have this sense of the cause giving up its entity into the effect. Or the cause giving up its entity in order to make the effect.
But the cause in itself is an effect of another.
Of a previous cause. Yeah. So that's what these preliminary talks is trying to get us to understand. We haven't really got time to go into too much detail here. But yeah, if you look at the debating texts that introduce cause and effect. You know, the direct effect, direct cause, you know, indirect effect, indirect cause, you know, so how these all relate to each other. So you get some good debates out of those. And then there's another, you know, that's indirect and direct in terms of time, yeah? So first if you have fuel gives rise to fire, then fire gives rise to smoke. You see what I mean? So if you're taking the effect as a smoke, you know, so you can say fire is the direct cause, but then fuel or firewood is the indirect cause of the smoke. But it's the direct cause of the fire. But then the fuel is coming, you know, that's got a cause and so forth. So yeah, so you have start to get a sort of a kind of more conscious understanding of cause and effect in all of its workings. And then we have the substantial cause versus the cooperative conditions. So the substantial cause is the thing which becomes that particular effect. So if you've got a clay pot, the thing which becomes the clay pot is, of course, the clay. You know, the wet clay, the potter molds, and that's what becomes the. So that's the substantial cause of the pot. But we also have cooperative conditions. So what might be a cooperative condition of the pot? It doesn't become the entity of the pot, but it's, you know, essential for the production of the pot, clay pot. So we can talk about the potter, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and all the bits and pieces. Yeah, so again, you know, for one cause to arise, so many different, one effect to arise, so many different causes and conditions have to come together.
So some of those will go into the entity of the effect. The clay becomes the clay pot. It changes its nature from being soft and, you know, powdery or whatever, into something which is hard and brittle, but, you know, maybe performs the function of holding water, which is what you want the pot to do. But then there are other essential elements, yeah? There are other contributing conditions, such as the potter and the wheel and the kiln and so forth. So these are the kind of things where you start sort of breaking down cause and effect into different categories, and you get some sort of insight into the way the Buddhists are coming at it, you know, and how this is going to point to impermanence.
Can a pot or something have more than one direct?
Yes, the pot is the direct cause of the pot, isn't it? Or the kiln is the direct cause of the pot, and the clay is the direct cause of the pot. The fire is a direct cause of the pot.
You can only see that if you look back. You don't know where something's going when it starts out, do you?
No, I mean,
you can only see the root when it goes back.
Often the potter will take the pot out and it's cracked, you know, so you won't hold any water at all, so that's not good. So.
But you can see that even. Mm.
Some of the seeds that the farmer casts, they won't grow. They will just be infertile, or, you know, they're diseased or something. So, yeah. So that's.
So we
can never
presume anything in a way which.
Well, if all the necessary conditions come together, and all the contrary conditions are prevented. Then the cause will arise, then the effect will arise unstoppably, it says. There's no way the effect can't arise. If all the causes are there and the opposing conditions are, you know, prevented, then there's no way that the effect cannot arise. So that's powerful. Yeah, okay, so the text continues. So just a bit of a roundup now from this first section. So, as far as hindrances are concerned, we clear away the opposing conditions, and as far as coming to fruition is concerned, we rely on the conducive conditions. And as above, if we rely upon them properly, not mistaking their nature, not muddling their order, and not missing any of their number out, then the particular effect will arise unstoppably. This is the reality of compounded things. The commentary on valley cognition, now that's by Dharmakirti, who's like the Buddhist master who's in the Mahayana tradition, at least, the Indian Buddhist master who's, you know, really seen as like the founding father, the great expert on logic, you know, and sort of reasoning. So he says, if nothing missing from the cause, then nothing can prevent the effect. Thus, from the great result, Buddhahood, down to the small, the crops of this world onwards, if what we desire does not come about, then the fault is either we have not made effort at the cause of whatever, or we have made effort at it, but at a cause, we have made effort, but at a cause inappropriate to the effect. Or it is appropriate, but it is incomplete. Or the causes are complete, but the order was mistaken. Or else it was not mistaken, but opposing conditions overcame. In the proof of that, it says, if it were not like that, then there is nowhere it would not arise. So if you're saying something can arise without causes, you know, or, you know, by chance, then why doesn't it arise everywhere? If it arises in one place, it should arise everywhere. If it arises, you know, without needing, you know, this full sort of causal network to produce it, then why doesn't it just arise all the time everywhere? Yeah, so that's what you have to say to somebody who says things arise by chance, some things happen by chance, like our sort of suffering, whatever. Right, now, the next section is particular explanations by way of nature. So that's something which is talking about what's it to be the nature of a Buddhist path, what's the reasoning that establishes past and future lives.
And topics like that, you know, he talks about the reasons establishing karma and the reasons establishing, you know, the state of omniscience. But I'm going to jump over those because we want to get more to this section on impermanence, I think. Well, don't the causes and conditions in turn lack inherent existence? They only arise in dependence upon things other than themselves.
Yeah, so a brick or bricks make a house, but the bricks don't have to be absent or inherent.
So the house is made from the bricks, is it? So that means the house depends upon the bricks. So how can it be independent? How can it have any inherent existence by way of its own nature? It's completely dependent upon causes and conditions. And its parts, yeah. Well, you can see how the house depends upon the bricks. It depends upon the brick layers, and depends upon the, you know, somebody thinking, oh, we'll build a wall here and a wall there, some kind of designer. So then, isn't the brick like that? The bricks only comes out around in dependence upon somebody gathering all the wet clay, stuffing it in the square mold and, you know, compressing it down and taking it out and drying it. So how can the brick be inherently existent? It's just completely dependent upon other factors. Yeah, but the brick is made of clay, so the clay is supposed to be inherently existent, but the clay is a mixture of, you know, water and this sort of, you know, powdered rock of some kind. So how can the clay be inherently existent? It only comes about in dependence upon, you know, the mixing of you know, this powdered rock with water. What makes it mix? Well, it's the rain falls on it, or, you know, the river runs over it, or, you know, it's somebody pours water over it, and, you know. So where's your inherently existent, you know, things out of which all these other things get made? Whatever you look, whatever cause you look at, it's always going to just arise from other causes. So nothing is kind of independently there whatsoever. Even if you go back to the beginning of the universe. Janet.
is sort of saying that the nature of what's making these things, sort of what's the propensities, what's sort of fueling this change is kind of an inherent kind of thing in itself. Is that what you sort of maybe getting at? A bit like
possibly.
The law of karma, in the sense, sort of being an inherent entity in all things that arise due to their
maybe. Yeah, I mean, there are the sort of the law of cause and effect, as if that has some sort of inherent nature of its own, you know, whether it's karmic cause and effect or just the fact of cause and effect that materialist scientists would also recognize and be happy to discuss. But that's the nature of the way things are. But it's still only like an extrapolation from, you know, a continual, you know, one thing depending upon another. So I don't think that has any, you know, kind of a independent nature of its own. It's only like, you know, an observation that we make conceiving how this is the nature of the way things are. But does that have to make it inherently existing? I don't think so. Nothing exists but what it depends on other things. So, but yeah, inherent existence is a deep subject, so lack of inherent existence is this self and selflessness. So here we're trying to get at the impermanent bit, so maybe we shouldn't divert too much along that track because it's a bit of a diversion given our subject today. Yeah, well, each cause has got to contribute to the effect. So if it's an opposing condition which just opposes one of the causes, then the effect won't arise in the manner you desire, you know, if one of the causes is absent.
So you have to go on the causes that you can know, and you have to obstruct that cause and try to prevent that from happening.
Indeed, I think so, yeah. So let's jump over to B, the explanation of impermanence, the indicated. Yeah. We've had a little discussion about compounded things. It's very little, I know. But some of you, at least, are sort of, you know, tuning in a bit, I think, and you know, seeing where these the implications of what's being said. And some of the implications are quite far-reaching. And, you know, it would be very nice to talk about past and future lives or inherent existence and all these other things that are coming up. But we should, I think, try to keep to our main topic. Well, my pages are probably different from yours because yours is printed here at the centre, but what page is it? Yeah, they haven't put page numbers on.
It's a capital T, and it's on the page that says 329.
Yeah. You've got these numbers in the margin, which should give the Tibetan page number. So there's the one that says 329. So I'm just going to read the verses above that. So this is his verses rounding off his section on compounded things. The knowing how compounded things abide, a dart to pierce 100 bafflements. This marvel by myself I could not see. The Lama's kind compassion is the means. Though knowing nothing of causality, by muddled meditation on its own, they seek to generate the path and fruits. The demon dullness hoodwinks them, that's all. Forever venturing virtuous deeds, and thus the best of happiness grows like the moon. Forever dealing sinful deeds, and thus the unwanted comes like thunder crashing down. Just he sees as they are causality, compounded things, and relativity. So Buddha's teachings on causality have not an atom stain of a mistake. So that's what authors inspire to write. So he's talking, you know, trying to bring us all these thoughts about cause and effect onto the path, you see, onto bringing us into, you know, our Buddhist progress, not just thinking of them as, you know, what they are in and of themselves, but what's the outcome of meditating on these things?
What's the outcome of meditating on impermanence going to be? Where does it lead us? See, so that's he's got that in his mind. What's the method, and what's the purpose? So let's go on to the explanation of impermanence, the indicated. So with regard to that, with regard to it, there are three nature divisions dispelling doubts. Nature. Number one, nature. As it appears in the close placement of mindfulness sutra, impermanence, which operates in a single moment. The defining characteristic of impermanence is momentary. Of the two, infinitesimally momentary and establishment time momentary. The latter is, as it says in the great commentary on fundamental wisdom, so that's by Tsongkhapa, the momentary which we state to be the defining characteristic of impermanence is not remaining for a second time after the time of its establishment. Not remaining for more than an instant is not the meaning of momentary. So this is one kind of pronouncement about impermanence, which, since it's from Tsongkhapa, has to be taken seriously. But we will find that Genlam Rinpoche is not taking this to be the subtlest meaning of impermanence. So it's not one that I'm going to sort of, you know, hang around with. So anyway, just we have this one was called establishment time momentary. Maybe that's not a very good translation, but it's the best I can do for the time being. So not remaining for a second time after the time of its establishment. So that's what Tsongkhapa says, you know. So the question comes up, what is the time of its establishment, you see? Does that mean when it comes into being? Or when its being is completed? So, anyway, so we just sort of pass on here, because we read the text, but we can't sort of just explain everything, because we haven't got time. So how to posit, then, the two types of momentary? An infinitesimal moment is the very last, briefest moment of time. Alternatively, there is the phrase, least briefest moment, which means the same thing. The duration of this. In the lesser vehicle, they assert 65 subtle moments operate in the duration of a finger snap. In the great vehicle, 365. However it is, such a moment is taught as a duration of an infinitesimal moment. So this is something which, you know, there are these guys, we can say the lower schools, the lesser vehicle, maybe the people holding the tenets of you know, other Buddhist schools. They do, in the end, posit a pathless moment. You know, they say that at a certain point you go down to a moment in time which cannot be further divided. Just as, you know, some people, these schools, also they like to posit there's an atom, you know, or a small particle beyond which you cannot go. You can't get any smaller than that. Yeah, and some people in physics, they talk about that the Planck length, don't they? There's Max Planck, the physicist, and he says this is the Planck length, is some very, very, very tiny, 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 minute length of which he came up with. I don't know how he comes up with it, you know. But anyway, it's named after him, isn't it? And it's, I don't know what it's for, but some physicists, on the basis of the calculations, they assume there's nothing smaller than this. It is incredibly minute, you know, so many zeros have to be there and there. But The higher schools are saying, yeah, but that's, they don't accept. Everything is partless. Everything has parts, I beg your pardon. So there's no such thing as a moment which is, you know, indivisible. There's no such thing as a particle that's so small that it cannot be further divided. Doesn't necessarily physically mean we have to be able to cut it in half some way. But, you know, it's got a left side and a right side. If it's a particle, it'll have, you know, an east side and a west side, for instance. Or if there's a moment, it'll have, you know, one part which is nearest to the moment comes after it, and it'll have another part which is nearest, you know, adjoining the moment which came before it. So when you start thinking like that, you get the idea of it is a complete continuum, you see. It's a complete little smooth kind of, you know, just evolution or transformation all the time. And this idea of chopping into moments might be convenient, you know, for talking about it or, you know, for explaining certain things. But in the end, that's just, you know, for convenience. Like we chop the day into 24 hours. Yeah? But it's not like, you know, there's some kind of steppiness or gappiness in a day, is it? It's just a very smooth thing, but we just imposing our divisions on it just for, you know, our own our own needs. So in the end, I think you have to say specifically in the high school at least, yeah, that all of these moments, that there's nothing kind of ultimate about them. They're all kind of, you know, divisible. So just he makes a remark about this establishment time momentary is a term which seems not to figure in the Indian text, but implicitly it may be culled from there. So with that in mind, it is used in the Tibetan texts. To illustrate it by means of a year, for instance, the time of its establishment is from the first moment up to the 12th. After that is a second establishment time. So this is called the momentariness of not abiding for a second establishment time. The reason being that it abides from the first month to the 12th, but does not abide after that. The quotation just quoted above continues. For a year to come to completion, 12 months must also come to completion, and a year does not abide after that. So all continua are momentary in the sense of not abiding for a second time after the time of their establishment. So, for him, for a year anyway, the time of the establishment of the year, when is the year established? Well, it seems like you have to wait until the end of the 12th month, don't you? So he's saying that's the establishment time. And it doesn't abide for a second moment after that. So it doesn't seem like a very subtle type of impermanence to me. But for something that, you know, that's a complicated, that's a specialized thing, isn't it? A year. But if you took it like a bowl like that, what's the establishment time of the bowl? Is it when it first becomes a bowl? Or is it when it's the establishment time is the whole of the time of its existence? So there's something there that I'm not sort of signed off on, personally. Yes.
You can't give it a time when it began and when it finished, because it's not a thing. Do you see what I mean?
Possibly. There's a continual flow. Like the bronze gets whatever brought to the foundry and it gets melted. Or it gets mixed in the foundry, whatever bronze is made of. If that's made of bronze, I don't know. What's bronze made of? Tin and copper or something? Copper and brass, or something? I don't know. You know, so somebody's sort of mixing the ingredients, and then it's all kind of melted. Then somebody comes along with pours it into the mold. Then it sets, has to cool down, then has to be, you know, polished and ground and so forth. And then, you know, it's packed in its box, it's ready to go to the shop.
Yeah,
so, and then eventually it'll get smashed or broken or crushed or,
it's,
you know.
The process of now decomposing.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's great. You see this evolutionary, you know, transformation going on, and this is just a phase. But there is a moment at which the bowl begins, and there is a moment at which it ends. There's a moment when it can do what it's supposed to do, produce a nice sort of a resonant sound, and there's a moment when it gets cracked or, you know, bents or whatever, so that it cannot do that anymore. So then that's the end of the singing bowl, whatever it is. So, you know, there's a time when we're born, the time when we die. But of course, you know, our continuum of consciousness is going on, you know, before that and after that. So, it's phases. So we're just picking out a phase within a continual flow there and say, during this time, it is a bowl. So yeah, that's to some extent that's arbitrary. You know, what do we mean by bowl? If we decide we know what it means, then we can say yes. This is for this time in the continuum of that substance, it was a bowl. But that's completely according to, you know, how we define a bowl. Yeah. So that's good. You see, this idea of the continuum is coming up. This continuum of change is what we're trying to realize. So then there's different types of continuum, though. So, you know, what you're asking is very relevant to what we're trying to get at here. Don't worry if you're not understanding everything, like, you know, what does it mean by establishment time? We haven't pinned that down. Don't worry. This isn't really the way we're going to come at emptiness by studying establishment time, the way we're coming at it impermanence, I mean. So this is just something he wants to pass through because it is something that's mentioned by Tsongkhapa, and if he mentioned it, then it shouldn't really be ignored. But we'll see how he does disagree a bit later on.
The continuum is time, not the fact that we label something as a year or a month. That's what we've done. Different people label it in different ways.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the Muslims, you ask them when did this year begin, and they might say, oh, that began in, you know, 15th of September, you know. Yeah. And the different lengths, you know, the Muslim year is a few days shorter than our year, isn't it? Pardon? Yeah. But that label is perfectly legitimate. That doesn't mean it's illegitimate. Just because it only exists because we've labeled it to exist doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It means it still exists, but only through mere labeling. But then there's nothing surprising about that, yeah? I know labeling is done for, you know, convenience. It's done for serious purposes. It's not just done arbitrarily. So it has a purpose to it.
So the idea of the teachings of impermanence is to let go of the idea of self and other, and what is the aim of the teaching? Is it just to let go of self, to let go of other, and the idea is just continual?
I think the purpose of when you talk about letting go of self and other, that's the teaching of selflessness. Yeah, so I would say I put that one a little bit to one side. So the teaching of impermanence is to really make you focus on what's important in life. So if after meditating on impermanence you found that, you know, worldly pleasures became less important to you, you know, then I would say that teaching's having the effect that Buddha desired, you know, that the worldly happiness is always breaking down on us. This is, you know, like birth, aging, sickness, and death, you know, so all the glories of the world end up in ruination. So that's not the direct sort of impact of the teaching on impermanence. That's sort of, you know, so therefore impermanence means, you know, all your attempts at worldly happiness are inevitably undermined, yeah. So if you're a materialist who just thinks that this life is all there is, then, you know, that's don't really think like that. They'd rather ignore it, you know, and just get on with enjoying themselves or something. But if you're a person who looks ahead and say, yeah, well, the body dies, but the mind goes on, and then, you know, there's no need to be reborn in a world where suffering goes on and on occurring. You know, there's a way of extracting ourselves through from this round of, you know, samsara. Then you know, we get interested in putting all our efforts in life into that, rather than just chasing after the sort of more ephemeral pleasures and sort of undependable pleasures of cyclic existence. So it's lessening your kind of, you know, interest in, you know, things which aren't really going to bring you dependable, lasting happiness, and turning away for, you know, the dependable and lasting happiness of liberation. Based on, you know, the fundamental ideas that the mind is formless. Yeah, the mind goes on from this life to another life and another one and another one. And what affects how we wander into happiness or suffering? Well, but, you know, the karma that we're producing, yeah, favorable, you know, helpful, good causes lead to happiness, you know, exploiting others, you know, putting our happiness before others, you know, committing negative actions leads us into, you know, suffering. And what's the way to withdraw out of all that fluctuation? To meditate on selflessness. So, you know, there's much more important things to be doing than just building all your hopes on worldly happiness. So the impact of impermanence is something like that. So see how we feel. That we could meditate now. It's time we did. It's good to have your questions. It's good to have your points. But it's good to turn inwards and, you know, think about the way things are just in that sort of private space of contemplation. So we did, the first one we did was the outer world. So this one is going to be on turning into the inner world, which means, you know, the world of ourselves, the world of our own minds. So, and it's good in the, it's very much part of the Lam Rim path, the graded path of the stages to enlightenment, to meditate on impending death. You know, obviously a very gross type of impermanence, but it's something we recommend to meditate on again and again every day. So yeah, the guru is here. The gurus can give us marvelous insights into, you know, this is the way that lasting happiness is to be found. You have a great potential. You've been born human. You haven't been born in some sort of dismal place where you have an animal's body. You can't even think what the difference between good and bad is. The difference between, you know, wisdom and ignorance. I haven't got a clue. You know, you've been given a great fortunate opportunity now. But such is the transience of life that unless you attend to what's important now, you know, you're only just going to die saying, "Oh, too late, too late." So we meditate on death, not to make us dejected and kind of, you know, hopeless and go and jump off the nearest bridge, but we meditate on death to give us a spur to action. Yeah, that. Really make us sort out the fool's gold from the actual gold. Sort out the wheat from the chaff. Are you going to chase after chaff like silly children, or are we going to go for the gold, you know, the wheat, you know, the real sort of, you know, a generous gift of Mother Earth to us? So this one Tibetan master called Gampopa, he has 4 points on meditating about this, the end of life. So first of all, let's spend a minute on relaxing the mind. So first of all, don't just take a few deep breaths. Concentrate on the breathing. And just make sure you're relaxed. And give the mind a chance to become alert and attentive and gathered.
So let's just very briefly remember the objects of refuge. So that's the teacher, and then his the wisdom of his or her teachings, and then the community of those who are, you know, involved and have deeply understood the teachings, some sort of direct realization. So they're also at a very advanced level, the community of the great beings, or the Sangha. So out of all those three, it's the wisdom of the teachings themselves. That's the actual refuge. That's the kind of input we need to, you know, really bring about a change in our mind, you know, bring about steering ourselves in a wholesome direction. So whether we're Buddhists or not, you know, the wisdom teachings are sort of, maybe we can feel that they abide in the universe. So there's a wisdom to be known if we can connect with it. So we rejoice in that you know, turn towards it. We don't just find it and it presents itself and we know it's all true and, oh yes, that's the wonderful thing. We have to think, is this gold or is it fool's gold? You know, it's up to us. We have to decide, is this the authentic teaching or not? But with the faith that there is an authentic teaching there that does lead from the darkness to the light, does lead from instability to you know, highest happiness. So the enlightened beings shine down their blessings on us, their encouragement, their inspiration. And we determine that we're doing this, you know, to be like them, not just for our own satisfaction, but fulfill the longing of all beings to find happiness, the longing of all creatures in samsara to, you know, find some dependable place, some dependable level there, where their sufferings are behind them. So we're working for wisdom which embraces all of those. So in terms of our own impermanence then, we have this glorious opportunity of a precious sort of human life with this spark of intelligence. But if we just put off our Dharma practice, we just put off our investigations, I'm too busy now I'm doing this will take a few years to complete, then when I've got things established, then I'll be able to, you know, do some Dharma practice. Fatal error. So four things to attend to from Gampopa. First of all, to death itself. I shan't remain for long. I will have to move on very soon. This combination of body and mind is extraordinarily complex. For my continued survival, you know, there's so many conditions
need to be fulfilled. So that makes me extremely vulnerable. And there's no doubt that after some time, quite soon, or a little bit later, then, you know, this combination will not be able to sustain. Definitely will come apart. And I must leave the body behind. My mind goes on. So I'm just like an arrow shot by an archer, or by like a water's gone over a steep cliff. That the end is like guaranteed. Second point we should attend to. He says, attend to the signs of death. So now we just think what it is, what it actually is like to die. So we don't have to have any fancy, you know, esoteric kind of withdrawing of the elements one into another, as it is done in a more elaborate way. But we can just think of our own passing away. We've seen other people or other creatures die. So just imagine it happening to us now. So if it is a sort of death which is kind of semi-peaceful and not by a sudden accident, a sudden kind of, you know, destruction of the body, then it might be that we do, you know, go through that process of, you know, the consciousness is withdrawing inwards. You know, the senses are shutting down. We no longer see, we no longer hear, but still there's a little bit of life. Still we have some sort of a, you know, a sense that we are surrounded by our loved ones or whatever situation we're in. There's still a spark of a consciousness left in the body. The breath becomes more and more hesitant. The out breath is long, but the in breath is hesitant and stuttering. And finally, there is no further in-breath. Then the body and the mind must part company. And the body shrivels or grows cold, stiffens, So then the mind has to move on. So number three is to think then that life is always dwindling away. So life is getting shorter all the time. So that death is getting nearer all the time. It's not just something that's ahead that's, you know, just sort of looming one day, but each day it's coming nearer. So a moment passes. And a minute passes. And an hour passes. Then a day passes. So we can look back to April of 2012 and now a year has passed already. So life shortens and shortens. And there's no saying that, there's no fixed lifespan. Highly unpredictable when our life will terminate. Some live until they're 100. Some die on the day of their birth, before they're even born. Always the hour of our death is approaching, but we never know when it will be. So we've meditated on the impermanence of the outer world. And now we can meditate on the impermanence of what's within, just passing away towards death, towards the next life. So just to rest the mind, or just to focus the mind on that sense of transience. Heading for that sort of, that gateway where all the things we built up in this life are just going to leave them behind. Our friends, our relatives, our dear ones, our property, our wealth, our money. we'll be bereft of all of them. Go on alone. Even the clothes we're wearing, and even our own body, will just have to be abandoned. So what does accompany the mind when it wanders on alone? Well, just those imprints of the good deeds you've done, you know, the bad deeds you've done, just those shaping factors. Just, you know, the extent to which you've trained your mind. In the trauma of death, you know, the personality and everything's forgotten. But those, you know, conditioning kind of imprints or seeds of your various actions, they're not lost. So it's the ripening up of one of those that determines what kind of life you experience next. So that's, you know, one level of Dharma practice to make sure that you lay down a maximum of good conditioning for your mind. Turn away from negative side of taking advantage of others for your own temporary happiness. So it's up to us then. We determine, in view of our situation here, we determine to practice the Dharma. And to practice it now. And practice it purely, not in any sort of mixed, half-hearted fashion, but seeing how, you know, future lives are kind of much more extensive, much more possibilities than just being distracted by the attractions of just this particular lifetime, just this particular body. So let's just dedicate the good energy we've aroused, the merit we've created towards becoming enlightened for the sake of all sentient beings. And stop there. So we'll need our impermanent bodies for a little while longer. So let's fortify them with a bit of lunch. See you 2:15. So 1 1/4 hours lunch break.